Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Ron Sutherland. He's a conservation scientist with Wildlands Network, a nonprofit group dedicated to reconnecting nature in North America. A native of North Carolina, Ron received a master's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a PhD from the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. We're going to talk today about red wolves. So first off, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
No problem. Great to be here.
So tell me about red wolves.
Sure. Well, red wolves are a fascinating species in part because nobody knows anything about them, at least in the general public. It's a species that has fallen under the radar for many, many years. Everybody's seen footage of gray wolves on television and documentaries and everything else, and we know about the wolves in Yellowstone and things like that, but people don't know that there was this red wolf, the eastern wolf, and it was actually driven extinct in the wild and then reintroduced to eastern North Carolina back in 1987, and that was 8 years before the gray wolf program got started at Yellowstone. But remarkably, it has escaped notice from most people. And the red wolf is a small wolf. It's sort of intermediate in size between a coyote and a larger gray wolf. Red wolves are about 50 to 80 pounds and about 5 feet long from nose to tail. And they live in small packs, small family groups, and they roam around and eat deer and raccoons and a variety of smaller creatures, rodents and things like that as well. But right now there's only about 100 of them left in the wild, and about 200 in captive breeding programs in zoos scattered across the country. And that makes them actually one of the most endangered, critically endangered wild species in the world, really, especially if you're looking at mammals. So it's a fascinating species that has just escaped everyone's attention.
So what was their historical range? Not commonality, not frequency, abundance. And were they always rare, or were they driven this way?
Yeah, well, I think the historical range, as far as we know, was essentially most of eastern North America, from southern Canada and sort of Maine and New York, all the way down to the tip of Florida, and then over to Texas. And we think that the red wolf, based on genetic studies, we think the red wolf is a sister species of the coyote. The red wolf and the coyote were these ancestral North American canids that were here, been here for hundreds of thousands of years. And more recently, the gray wolf kind of arrived across the Bering Land Bridge and came down and colonized as well. Looking back before the gray wolf got here, you would have had the red wolf in the east and then the coyote in the west. And somewhere in the middle, there probably was a zone of hybridization, a natural zone of hybridization between the two. But in terms of how many there are or how many there were, I think it's safe to say hundreds of thousands in the eastern United States. And they were still, people could still find them right up until the 1960s, and then they noticed that they were becoming almost impossible to find. So,
and what were the causes of decline, or what have been the causes of decline?
Yeah, the big one is persecution by people. The eastern part of the country was colonized by Europeans a lot sooner than the western parts, and so we lost our wolves much sooner. Back in the day, they had basically cut down most of the trees in the east, so it made it a lot easier to find and shoot the wolves and trap them. Basically, farmers and livestock owners didn't tolerate having the wolves anywhere near them on the landscape, so they shot them all. And the last wolves, down in coastal Texas, they came under pressure from coyotes that were moving into the void that was created by the absence of the wolves. And so the last few red wolves in Texas were surrounded by kind of an advancing sea of coyotes, and there was some hybridization going on there. So that, you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service in the 60s and 70s was worried that hybridization was going to be the final straw that got rid of the red wolf. But the bigger picture was, you know, so many of the wolves were shot, and their habitat was temporarily destroyed. You know, a lot of the forest has since grown back, so there's actually a lot of great red wolf habitat out there.
You know, that's been a theme in some of the interviews I've done. I've talked to people about like livestock grazing on public lands in the West, and talked to people about wolves specifically, both Mexican wolves and timber wolves, and just a theme has been this culture's hatred of wolves, and the like in the West, with a lot of the public lands grazing, there are programs in place where ranchers will get paid twice the financial value of or more for every cow that's killed by a wolf. And you know, from a strictly capitalist perspective, what that would mean is you want to tether all your cows out there and have them killed by wolves because you get paid twice as much as you get the market value. But instead, they will insist they don't want to get paid, but instead they want the cows, the wolves all shot. Do you have any? What is your perspective on this culture's hatred of wolves?
It's hard to understand. I mean, I guess it, you know, charitably, it probably stems from when most of us were peasants living in Europe, you know, at least those of us from European ancestry, and we were, you know, couldn't afford a gun or any kind of weaponry to protect ourselves, and then there were these wolves that would come out of the woodwork in Europe and Russia in places, and probably cyclically threaten people as food populations crashed for some ecological reason. But, you know, and that hasn't been the case for the last 400 or 500 years, really, it seems like. So I think it's just been perpetuated since then with a lot of mythology. You know, in my understanding, during the World War II, there was a lot of wolf mythology associated with the Nazi regime as well, and so that kind of reinforced everything that the Nazis were seen as wolves, and that's kind of stuck in people's mind as well. And, you know, I don't know. You know, for the red wolf, it has been kind of under the radar. There's not as much hatred towards it. In part, the red wolf got released into this area in eastern North Carolina that's kind of this big flat peninsula called the Albemarle Peninsula that it has farms, but they're mostly crop farms. There's not that much livestock, and I think the red wolf has really only been blamed for a few dozen cases of livestock predation in the last 27 years, and I think most, you know, two dozen of those were chickens. So, you know, that's really a remarkably small record. So there's not much of a reason to, from that perspective, to worry about the red wolf. You know, but I think it stems from our, to a certain extent, from our heritage. And so, you know, and it's this other thing, and it's a competitor. There's a lot of folks that hunt deer, but at the same time have a hard time tolerating this other animal out there that hunts deer. And that it's fascinating to me, because, you know, it seems like they should kind of begrudgingly respect the wolf as a kind of a comrade in arms that, you know, is out there hunting deer the same way they are. But instead, they, you know, people just tend to ascribe to the wolf all kinds of negative qualities and not focus on the positive things, which, you know, it seems like now half the country sees the positive about wolves, and, you know, get puts the wolf calendars up on their walls and thinks they're great, but then you still have the other half of the country really seeing wolves as these evil creatures.
So before we go any further, I want to sort of change tack for a second. Isn't there a weird thing with red wolves and climbing trees?
Huh. I haven't heard that one. I think coyotes can climb trees.
Oh, I'm completely wrong on this, because I remember reading, this goes all the way back to when I was a kid, reading like Ripley's Believe It or Not or something. I remember reading that red wolves are supposed to be one of the only canids who can climb trees. But if you're saying that's not the case, then who am I going to believe, you or Ripley's? I think I'll believe you.
one canid that does climb trees is the gray fox. And there's actually a fascinating story that's developing in the Northeast. They're starting to think that coyotes up in the Northeast are driving red fox populations away.
And red foxes are introduced, right? Red foxes are European, gray foxes. Or I know where I live here in Northern California, gray foxes are native.
Right, right. There's some debate, I think, about red foxes.
Okay, sorry.
And there's an interesting theory that the coyote is actually increasing Lyme disease because it's driving out the red foxes, which are great predators on deer mice, and deer mice are actually the bigger vector of Lyme disease than the deer themselves. And so you get an explosion of deer mice when you lose the red foxes, and the coyotes don't do enough. But down here, you know, we have a lot of gray foxes, and they climb trees really easily. And so I don't think the coyotes have as big of an impact on gray foxes. So.
Well, that brings up something else. Where I want to go in a second is to talk about the specifics of the captive breeding program and the successes of that. But before we go there, I just want to marvel for a second at the complexity of the real world. That, you know, when wolves got back to Yellowstone, then it, for example, improved trout habitat because it pushed the deer and elk away from the streams some, and also decreased their population, which allowed the willows to grow back, which allowed beavers to come back, which made better habitat for trout. And the thing that made me think of this is what you just said about Lyme disease. And so can you talk for a second about your bioregion, and if it were in a happy, healthy state, who would be some of the significant predators who were there? There'd be the red wolves, there'd be presumably panthers. Who else would be some of the predators who would be important to your region?
Yeah, the red wolf and the panther / eastern cougar would have been the big two. And there may have been gray wolves. I think what I've heard is the thinking is that gray wolves may have been up in the mountains, in the Appalachian Mountains, heading up to Canada from there. So that may have been a third species. And then we had, we have a lot of black bears as well. Black bears are omnivores, but they do eat deer and other species as well. So that, you know, that would have been the main complement, at least going back for 10,000 years. Before that, we would have had, you know, before the Pleistocene overkill, we would have had all kinds of interesting creatures. But just recently, you know, we've had the panthers and the wolves. And so they should have been maintaining the deer populations. They should have been kept in check. I'm sure they were still cyclical and up and down, but that's the way nature works. But, you know, definitely not a stable balance. But at the very least, the wolves and the panthers should have helped keep the deer in check, and that would have protected our native wildflower populations. You know, there's a lot of studies down here in North Carolina and then across the East about, you know, what happens to the understory when you lose. When you have too many deer, they basically eat, they mow down everything. As many gardeners in this part of the world know, that, you know, the deer will, when they get too abundant, they really can take out all the rare wildflowers. And that in turn has an impact on bird populations as well. And then there's the raccoons and possums and other sort of meso-predators, you know, middle-sized predators that are out there. And we think the red wolves, red wolves do eat raccoons and possums. And so they should have an impact on controlling those as well, which would have further protected the ground nesting birds like quail and whippoorwills and birds like that. The historical situation would have been rich with predators.
So tell me about first the political and then the sort of technical process of instituting the captive breeding program. I mean, so give me the history, starting maybe 10 years before. So the populations were, they were still somewhat common in the 60s, from what you said, and then the population started to really collapse, or noticeably collapse, and then what happened?
Well, I think when they went to look for them in the 60s, they realized there weren't very many at all, and so they started gearing up, and the Fish and Wildlife Service finally sent somebody down there, and people that want to read more about this can read it, the great history in Daleen Beelan's book, The Secret Lives of Red Wolves, I think it's called. But the Fish and Wildlife Service sent a biologist down to coastal Texas and Louisiana, and they spent some time down there, and they basically figured out that there was just this, you know, a few dozen of these animals left. And so they made this decision because they thought they were surrounded by coyotes and they might be, you know, hybridized out of existence pretty soon. And also I think the landowners weren't particularly favorable towards them. So they made the decision to try to capture as many of them as they could. And that took place between, I think, 1973 and 1980. It's actually a very sad tale how this went down. It was all before, you know, the age of modern genetics and DNA analysis and things, and so we have to consider that before we judge them too harshly. But what they did is they caught 400 different wild canids down there in coastal Texas, and of those, they trimmed it down to about 40 of those. They, using morphological analysis, they decided were, you know, most likely red wolves, and then they did some breeding experiments with those and looked at which ones had wolf-like puppies, and then they trimmed that down again to 17 animals, and wasn't very many, and three of those animals were too old to breed or something, just didn't reproduce. And so the entire captive population of red wolves was founded by this group of 14 animals, and they discarded basically all the rest. These days they could have tested all the rest just to see if they had any kind of red wolf DNA in them as well, and you probably could have saved more of the red wolf, you know, genetic diversity by keeping more of the hybrids and doing something with it. But then all they could think of to do was to get rid of them. So. And I think it was basically the first time a species had been driven extinct in the wild. I think this was before the California condor experiment, where they took, you know, the last similar situation, the last, you know, dozen or two California condors out of the wild and then started a captive breeding program. And I think the red wolves are probably probably easier to breed than than condors. But and then it wasn't too many years before they started looking for a place to reintroduce them.
And how did they decide to do North Carolina? Before we go there, was this politically problematical, or was this politically pretty easy? Was it a big fight to make this happen, or did it happen just were the problems strictly technical?
I think at the time, you know, there wasn't much going on in the South in the 70s. I think think people just kind of flew under the radar of everyone, that they were, Fish and Wildlife Service was, you know, going to these really remote parts of the deep south and trying to catch these last wolves. It had been a long time in most of the, you know, southern states. It had been a long time since people had even seen a wolf, and so I think it just kind of went under the radar. You know, there wasn't all the communications tools we have now to get people worked up about it, so they were able to operate.
And then what about, why was North Carolina chosen to release?
You know, the main reason, to my knowledge, is that they determined that eastern North Carolina, especially this peninsula, the Albemarle Peninsula, didn't have coyotes. And so they thought that by starting the wolves back in this peninsula and on there's a brand new National Wildlife Refuge, Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge, that's, you know, it's a big, we thought, you know, they thought at the time it was a, you know, huge tract of land that they could establish a pack of wolves on, or a population of wolves on. But they figured that the coyotes wouldn't get there for 20 years, and so they would have time to create a pretty robust wolf population again that would withstand the coyotes when they got there. But it turned out that due to, you know, coyotes moving on their own, and also fox hunters would create these what they call fox pens and then put coyotes in them instead of foxes to train their dogs on, and the coyotes would often get out, and this happened a lot in eastern North Carolina, and so the coyotes actually showed up I think by basically the early 1990s. So the red wolves were released in 1987, and just a few years later they had coyotes showing up at the door.
And what has happened because of that?
It's been a kind of a very challenging situation. It's a unusual situation to try to be restoring an endangered species in the presence of a very closely related sister species that, you know, would have lived somewhere else, but has come back in to occupy the void of the rare species. So the coyote, you know, there was one case where the coyotes came in and bred with the red wolves, and before they, you know, they didn't notice it until after the hybrid offspring kind of entered into the population. So that there's one recorded example of coyote hybrids sort of entering in. So then they think that the red wolves that are out there can all have some coyote ancestry, which is not that meaningful, since they're closely related species anyways that would have interbred in the middle anyways. But when they figured out that hybridization was still a threat to the species, the Fish and Wildlife Service undertook to try to do this adaptive management program where they would try to catch the wolves and catch the coyotes on a regular basis. And anytime they would find evidence of a wolf and a coyote breeding, they hit on this strategy of sterilizing the coyotes as placeholders, because they figured out that, as many people, you know, farmers and ranchers in western states had figured out before, it's really hard to get rid of coyotes once they're around. And so if they'd just gone around shooting all the coyotes in the red wolf area, not only would have, you know, they probably would have shot some red wolves, but also the coyotes would have filled those voids pretty quick. And so what they decided to do was catch the coyotes, catch the hybrids, and sterilize them, and then they would hold their territories for another, you know, the rest of their lifespan, because they're territorial animals, but they wouldn't be producing any more hybrid litters, and they would give, that would give the pure red wolves, you know, a greater chance to keep breeding and keep expanding. And that strategy seemed to be actually working through the 2000s. But then at the end of the 2000s, the mortality rate, gunshot mortality rate for red wolves went way up, you know, probably as a result of a few people deciding to start shooting them that live down there. And once the wolves were getting shot more, then you had these single wolves that needed a mate, and there was always coyotes around, and so the coyote hybridization problem kind of reared up again. And it's a really it's going to be a challenge to try to restore a relatively pure red wolf population now if you can't control the number of wolves that are getting sort of shot down every year.
That was actually the next question I was going to ask, is what has been the local response? Because I know where I live in far, far northern California on the coast, and one of the ways I describe the politics here is it's kind of like Mississippi on the north coast. It's extremely conservative. You know, I always think of Northern California as all groovy and lefty and all that, but actually far northern California is... I don't think that reactionary is too strong a word, and I don't think that anti-environmental is too strong a word. And so here, if one were to try to do this... Well, actually, I don't know if this is quite true, because on one hand, you have like the Indian nations are still very strong here, and they have been really eager to help reintroduce the California condor. So on one hand, you have that influence. On the other hand, you have sort of the mainstream culture of this of the non-indigenous population here, which is would be along the well. There are some struggles about the condor that people are really opposed to not using lead bullets. They don't want to change that, and of course that's the condors get lead poisoning from eating animals who've been shot by lead bullets. Anyway, the point is how are the, I mean, you kind of gave me the answer with the shooting, but that's perhaps only a few. How has been the local response? Are people really happy to have the wolves reintroduced? Is this an exciting thing, or is this a terrible thing? Is it really mixed?
I think it's been kind of cyclical, I think. I think there was opposition at first, as you might expect, if you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service announces they're going to release this top carnivore back into the landscape. There was opposition from the locals that were going to be affected. There's not that many people that live in this 5-county area. And you know, at the time, the Fish and Wildlife Service said they were going to put the wolves into these national wildlife refuges and try to manage them there. And I think people were more or less okay with that. And then it, you know, as most of us, you know, can easily predict now with hindsight, the wolves didn't want to stay put where they put them, particularly because there's more deer and other things to eat, you know, outside of the sort of thick Pocosin swamps that are in the wildlife refuges. And then you have these farms next door, and that's where all the deer are. And so the wolves went out into the farms. And so I think there's been some undercurrents of betrayal because of that. You know, the Fish and Wildlife Service misled people that, you know, the wolves were going to stay on federal land, and here they are trying to restore them to this entire 5-county area. So I think that has upset some people. But I think for a lot, you know, for 20, 25 years, the overall picture has been general, you know, either tolerance or ignorance of the fact that it's even going on. Because you can drive from Raleigh and Durham, you know, down to the Outer Banks to go to the beach, and you can drive actually right through the Red Wolf Recovery Area. And so millions of people have done that over the last 20 years, and I think very few people actually know they're driving through a wolf recovery zone. You know, it's not very easy to know. There's a few, you know, wolf crossing signs on the highway that you might see, but it's easy to miss those. And so I think, and the other big factor, and I think it was part of the reason they chose that area for the wolves as well, is that it's a big crop farming area, and so you have these farmers that are growing corn and other crops. And so deer are actually more of a nuisance to them, and so the red wolf can be seen as a bit of a boon. It's helping reduce crop damage. In fact, I've looked at the data from the Wildlife Commission, and they actually give farmers down in that area permits to shoot as many deer as they want as crop pests. And so that, you know, I think there's been tolerance of the wolf because of that. It's, you know, the wolf is down there eating some deer, and I think that's okay with the people that are trying to make their living growing crops. And it's, you know, it really is a big flat agricultural area outside of the swamps, and there's not that much livestock going on.
So you said
that was pretty stable, and then just in the last couple of years, there's been one or two people that have taken it on themselves to really agitate against the wolf, and it's not clear at all why they're doing it.
Right. Well, this is a story that I've told a couple times before, but I think it's a really important story that when the Europeans arrived on this continent, there soon after that, a bunch of Indian nations in the Northeast got together to have basically just a get-together to try to figure out. They couldn't understand why the colonizers were killing all the wolves. And so they all got together to talk about it. And what they all came up with after several days of talking about it is basically they're just crazy. And that's you know, I've lived my whole life in the rural West, and that's basically all I can come up with for, you know, it's the same with prairie dogs too, you know, that there's this complete, I grew up in Eastern Colorado on the Front Range, and oh my gosh, I mean, there's this completely outrageous hatred of prairie dogs. It just doesn't make any sense. Anyway, so leaving that aside, let's go back to, you said there's how many wolves in the wild right now and how many wolves in captivity?
We think there's about 100 wolves in the wild and about 200 in captivity.
And are they still, is the captive breeding program still active, and are they still releasing additional wolves into the wild?
They are. I mean, they breed the wolves in captivity in part just to maintain that
right.
level of wolves in captivity, but they also, they do very detailed kind of stud book analysis of which, you know, genes they have represented in the captive population versus the wild population. And when a wild wolf pair has a small litter, you know, one or two pups, what they've figured out they can do, and this is another sort of first for this program, they figured out they can take, you know, the pups are born in captivity about the same time, and they'll take these pups with their eyes closed from the zoos and fly them down to North Carolina and put them out in the, you know, the little dugout den of the wild wolf with the other pups that are, you know, hunched on the ground, and the wolf mothers will adopt them. So it's this wolf, red wolf fostering program that's really cool. And that's a great way to do it, because then, you know, if you're releasing a captive wolf directly from captivity, it has nobody to teach it how to hunt and how to survive, whereas you do this fostering situation, then the wolves are raised by a wild mother that knows what to do. So,
how did they deal with that with the first ones they reintroduced?
Then they, I think what they were doing was a kind of a soft release program where they had some pins set up, both down there at Alligator River and then also in some island situations. Bull Island and coastal South Carolina, I think, was one of them, where they have a, you know, might have a big pin, or in the island, maybe they didn't have a pin at all. They just let the wolves run around the island, and they would bring them, at least at first, they would bring them roadkill deer and that kind of thing. And I think they just sort of hoped that they would adapt to finding their own food. And I guess they did, but I don't think it, you know, it's a hard road for an animal to come out of captivity like that. And especially, you know, these relatively smart, big-sized mammals that have a lot of social learning that goes on in their behavior. You know, they learn from each other about where the food resources are and that kind of thing. And I think that makes it hard. They're not pure instinct-driven animals like some other things. So
are there any even remote plans to even dreams of reintroducing in other places?
Well, actually, you know, fairly early on in the Eastern North Carolina program, they decided to go ahead full steam with another program up in the mountains, in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And so they actually started another population up there in 1992. And they only kept it going for 6 years, till 1998, when they decided to end the program. But there was a brief period there when you could go to the Great Smokies and actually see a red wolf out in the big open area of Cades Cove. What happened there that was similar to what happened at the coast, but the wolves didn't want to stay inside the kind of largely old-growth forests of the national park. The wolves wanted to go out into the lower elevations where that had been clear-cut and there was a lot of deer, and so the wolves left the park. And then there was also a lot of canid diseases that were in the surrounding area from people, you know, feral dogs and things. So the poor red wolf pups were all dying from parvovirus and distemper and other, you know, mange, I think. So they had really low pup survival. They also had a really hard time tracking those wolves. As you might imagine, the radio transmitters, when you're in kind of a steep mountain ravine kind of situation, the signal bounces all over the place, and it's really, you know, difficult terrain. So they couldn't keep track of them. They couldn't manage the things. And so they decided to pull the program, which a lot of us, you know, in hindsight, kind of wish they had not, and wish they had kept going with it. And there may have been some politics involved as well in that decision. But, you know, if they had kept going and been more flexible about allowing the wolves to go out into the national forest areas around the national park, for example, and done more to promote that, and if they, you know, had been patient until the technology came around with GPS collars and things to track the wolves, then I think it ultimately could have been more successful. And I think it actually could still be tried again. So, and that Great Smoky Mountains would be one place. It doesn't have as much deer as some other places in the southeast, or, you know, the rest of the eastern seaboard. So there's other places that could be tried as well. There was actually a movement to reintroduce them to coastal South Carolina. There's this Francis Marion National Forest there. It's a large national forest that would have been a good spot. And then there's, you know, the Ozarks out in Missouri, huge national forest with lots and lots of deer. West Virginia has the highest deer vehicle collision rates anywhere in the country. They have an amazing number of deer, and that would be a great place to think about a red wolf project. Now the politics being what they are, it's a lot harder, I think, to convince a state to allow this, you know, a new recovery program to start. So it would have to be years worth of outreach programs before you could get that underway. But we're hopeful.
And is that, you know, is that because of general politics, or is that because of not having money for the program, or both?
I think both. I mean, I think the two are connected. The Fish and Wildlife Service has been, their budget has been slashed to the bone for years, and then they, after it was slashed to the bone, then they still had to cut their funding some more. So they really don't have that much money, and I think if we could get a congressional delegation from a state that wanted to have red wolves reintroduced, and they could arrange for the, you know, line item funding to allow it, I think that would go a long way towards making it happen. And then, you know, so many of the states in this part of the world, you know, their politics kind of feeds off of hatred of the federal government, and so it's hard for the federal government to pull off something. You know, the Red Wolf reintroduction in North Carolina was pulled off during the Reagan years, which is kind of hard for people to believe now, but you know, for some reason it's even harder now. But I think, you know, if we can do the level of outreach that we need to do about the ecological benefits of the Red Wolf, then I think we can make some inroads there.
So if you can presume that anybody listening to this is biocentric. I mean, they care about the real world. They are quite possibly an activist, either a young activist or a seasoned activist. What can they do? What would help with this outreach? What can they do to help Red Wolves, A, if they live in North Carolina, or B, if they live in the South or Southeast, or C, if they live anywhere else? What can they do both? I mean, this doesn't sound like there's an active campaign that they should, A, write a letter. I mean, what can they do longer term to help with the Red Wolves?
Well, actually, there is kind of an active campaign. The Fish and Wildlife Service, at the behest of North Carolina's politicians, has sort of undertook this review of the Red Wolf Program last fall, and now they're actually very, very soon to announce their sort of decision about the future of the program, possibly even next month. So it's actually fairly urgent that anybody, wherever they live, can try to write the Fish and Wildlife Service to express their support for the Red Wolf Program. And I think, you know, various groups like the Red Wolf Coalition, Defenders of Wildlife, Wildlands Network that I work for, have links on their websites for how you can do that and contact. So we need people to write the Fish and Wildlife Service to say, you know, please don't give up on the Red Wolf Program, and instead let's expand it. Let's start talking about expansion. And then if you're in North Carolina, then writing the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission to help encourage them to not be so antagonistic towards the wolf, which has been their recent policy. Before that, they were ignoring the wolf, and now they're being antagonistic and asking the Red Wolf to be removed, basically. And so we need to contact them and let them know. And right now there's actually a public comment period going on about some new sort of coyote hunting rules that affect the Red Wolf area in eastern North Carolina. And so it's a perfect time for people to contact the Wildlife Commission. But then, you know, more generally, anybody that lives anywhere where there's coyotes, we need to work on people being accepting of coyotes in a general sense, because if folks can't live with a 35-pound coyote, then and they demonize the coyotes, and it's going to be uphill from there to get them to accept this 55-70-pound wolf, even though, you know, from a safety perspective, they're not really any different. Neither one are very much of a threat to people. So
coyotes are very adaptable. I mean, you know, there's coyotes who live in Los Angeles proper, you know, so are Red Wolves, if they're not actually shot, are they, let's pretend that the Red Wolves were not hybridizing. Let's get rid of that threat for a moment, and let's get rid of people with guns for a moment. Are Red Wolves able to take care of themselves pretty well? Because you said that the population in the Smoky Mountains, they're running into parvo, distemper, and I don't know how we deal with that in the short term, but like this population that's down, that's already established, if they were just pretty much left alone, would they be able to expand on their own?
I think so. Yeah, I'm optimistic that they could. They have abundant food resources available to them, and there's quite a bit of forest and sort of farm forest mixtures, which the wolves seem to appreciate. You know, they seem to be more shy of people than coyotes in that respect. So we may never see them in people's backyards, which I think most people would be fine with. But you know, I think the Red Wolf does have a lot of room for expansion, and I think it could happen. You know, finding some way of dealing with the coyote situation would be helpful. Either that or long term, we might end up with a situation where we have red wolf coyote hybrids on the landscape in the Southeast, at least in some areas. And that may be the end result that that gives us this wild canid back in the southeast that is, you know, adaptable and wily like the coyote and can get around people, but then has the larger body size of the wolf and has a better capacity for you know, ecologically benefiting southeastern forests.
So let's say that all of a sudden there was a completely unexpected stroke of sanity hit this culture, and they decided to take some of the military funding and, I don't know, build some schools or build some hospitals, and then they were going to throw some of this money at red wolves. You know, all of a sudden, instead of, you know, spending trillions of dollars to kill people all over the world, we're going to do something smart with it. And so they made you also, they sort of made you the emperor of the red wolf. What would you want to do if you could have sort of your wish list of policy? You can't take down capitalism, you can't take down civilization, you can't do those big, huge things. But what you can do is help the red wolf however much you can, and you have a decent budget. So what would you want to do? What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, wow. That would be fascinating. I think I'd start with actually funding the ecological studies of the red wolf that were never done, unlike the gray wolf, which has been, you know, studied extensively out in the Rockies. They didn't think to do all those kind of studies with the red wolf because it was the first project. And so I think there's a lot of room for funding that kind of work. And we actually are starting to, on a bit of a shoestring budget, we're getting some of those studies underway. But if, you know, we had real money, we could do a much better job. And you could actually look at coyotes as well in the same project. And then the second priority, I think, would be funding, you know, a much larger scale of outreach efforts aimed at actually educating the public in the Southeast about red wolves and their, you know, the relative risks they pose compared to other things like vacuum cleaners and you know, bees and peanut allergies and all that kind of things that are much more dangerous than red wolves are, and also their ecological benefits. So that could go hand in hand with the studies. And then I think I would fund, after a few years of that, I think I would fund two or three more reintroduction projects in other areas. And, you know, really do it right in terms of having good baseline data about what was there before they did the wolves, and then they add the wolves in. And I think at least one of those would be great to do a really experimental approach where you're just taking pure captive red wolves and putting them out on the landscape into the kind of the sea of coyotes that are already out there, and then using our modern genetic tools to actually measure how much hybridization is going on, and whether the red wolves can essentially hold their own. I think we don't really know that very well. You know, they've tried really hard to kind of handhold the red wolf in eastern North Carolina, but what happens if we ramp up the captive breeding program to, you know, 300 or 400 animals and start releasing, you know, a few dozen pure red wolves into a new site every year? Create kind of a waterfall effect where it sort of pushes out pure, you know, the red wolf genes out into the landscape. Do those wolf genes survive, and do we end up with a landscape that has a self-sustaining population of animals that ecologically behave like red wolves and have some of their genes in there? So I think that those things would be great. And if there was money left over, then we would want to expand some of our core wild areas in the Southeast and in Central Appalachians. You know, there's places where you can still piece together hundreds of thousands of acres of forest, you know, protecting those areas and connecting them. You know, that's Wildlands Network. That's our big focus, is connecting these wild areas across the continent to try to allow a species like the red wolf to survive. And so there's a lot of room to work on protecting habitat corridors between these different refuges so that even though not one, you know, no single place is big enough for a self-sustaining population of wolves, if you can connect them with a network of corridors that are protected, then it starts to look a lot more realistic that we can have a viable population of red wolves in this region.
Well, that all sounds really great. And I've interviewed people about the importance of the corridors and connecting those larger areas. And so we're out of time, and I would like to thank you so much for your work, and thank you for talking to me today. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ron Sutherland. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.